Hi, everybody. I'm Keith Lyons. I'm the coordinator of membership here at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. And I wanted to welcome you all here. And first, I wanted to thank our two co-sponsors for the event this weekend, the Arden Theater Company and the Philadelphia History Museum at the Atwater Kent. Specifically, I want to thank Lee Goldenberg at the Arden Theater Company. And I want to encourage you all to see their play, Wanamaker's Pursuit, that's running through May 22nd. And downstairs we have postcards, and with the postcards you get 50% off on the tickets there. I also want to thank Charles Croce and Kate Bigg and Kristen Froelich. All of who have been instrumental in bringing this to you. And I want to encourage you, if you haven't already, after the Q&A, to go back and look at the artifacts that we have on display, some of which are from the Historical Society's collection. Others are from the Philadelphia History Museum, formerly known as the Atwater Kent. And I want to mention that they're also preparing for their reopening this fall, and it's a great place. If you've never been, I definitely encourage you to check it out as soon as they open up. Just to tell you a couple quick things about the Historical Society. We're founded in 1824. We're one of the oldest historical societies in the country. We like to put on lots of great events like this. Without further ado, I want to introduce our speaker to this evening, who's an oboist with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, as well as a town crier for the Preservation Society in Baltimore. And he is the author of Hutzler's, Where Baltimore Shops, and Wanamaker's, Meet Me at the Eagle. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Michael J. Lozinski.
Thanks, Keith. Before I go any farther, I do have to thank everybody here at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania and also the sponsors, the co-sponsors, the Arden Theater, as well as the Philadelphia History Museum to help bring this real important, I think, important event to be. Because I wrote the book. it's important. Couple reasons. First of all, Wanamaker's, the building, the Wanamaker building that we have there at 13th and Market, it's 100 years this year. That's a big event. And I'm also honored to be here because the Wanamaker papers are stored down below in the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. So it's kind of almost like a coming of home for me to come here and speak about Wanamaker's. Now, I've been doing a lot of talks about department stores for the past year and a half. It's been quite a different lifestyle than I've had before. And I always like to be a little defensive about why I'm even here, because I don't really know why I'm wired to like department stores. I don't know. And I will ask anybody here, why are you wired to like a certain perfume? Why are you wired to like a certain color? If you can explain it to me, I'll listen to you, but I don't know why I'm wired to like department stores. I never worked in a department store. I'm not a Wanamaker or a Hutzler. I've never studied retail, and up until 2009, I never wrote anything, basically, in my life. I was born in Camden. I don't live here anymore in the Philadelphia area. I was born in Camden. I grew up in Cherry Hill, and I'm an oboist in the Baltimore Symphony. That's always been my identity. It's always been music. And for some reason, I've always had this crazy obsession about department stores, this closeted obsession, stuff I wouldn't share with people. And if I'm going to blame anybody on this obsession, it's going to be my mother. And I'll get to that later. Because first of all, I'll go ahead and admit that I was born in 1964. And if you look at any of like government statistics, the psychological statistics or what, it is the final year of the baby boomer generation. I'm at the end of that. And I see that I grew up at the tail end of the department store era. because my mother was loyal to department stores. Yeah, we grew up across the river, but Philadelphia was still our hometown. And, you know, we shopped at all the stores. Each of these stores, we'll say six stores on Market Street, each of them had their certain clientele, their certain demographic. And, you know, we kind of went to all of them. And I have to admit, the one store we really didn't go to much was Wanamaker's. Because my mother's store was Strawbridge and Clothier. And, you know, you're going to find people in the city that are kind of one or the other. And that's fine. It was her first job. And she started out in candy and graduated to gift wrap. She sang in the chorus for a number of years, even after she left. And she kind of taught me about being loyal to that store. I mean, like Clover Day. I mean, that was just kind of a nuts thing when it happened in the house, you know? I mean, if you didn't know where my mother was and you were alone or wherever, she was a Clover Day. And the other thing she liked to do, and this worked with supermarkets as well, she would get in the car when we had a day off and say that we're going to Trenton, we're going to Wilmington, we're going to Baltimore. What grocery store do you want to go to today? I mean, it was never the same routine. We always were looking at something different and just something that we weren't. I mean, yeah, we had our loyal stores, but we also went to look at something new. And as a kid that couldn't keep his head hanging out the window, I was fascinated. I know, like, you know, going to Trenton, big whoop. I mean, people go to Paris. That's a big vacation. I was fine in Trenton. And, you know, I was just real interested on how each of these cities, large or small, had these different names, these different logos. And it was just, since that's what my mother knew, that's where we first went. And I would identify these places through their stores. 1972, I was 8 years old, and I remember getting the news that the Litz in downtown Camden was closing. I should say Lip Brothers. My brother would say it's blasphemous to call it Litz. And I remember thinking when I was 8 years old, what's going to happen to Camden? I think a lot's happened to Camden since. But I was still really upset. I mean, that's what I knew about Camden, was Lip Brothers. And over the years, I saw these stores go one by one. I mean, I knew when Lip Brothers closed in 77 as an entire chain, it made some sense to me because, I mean, you remember how that store looked on Market Street after it closed. Beautiful iron front building, but it was falling down, it was rotting, it was peeling. It was something in desperate need of renovation, and it's nice to see what it is now. But Lip Brothers stores were in urban areas, were in deteriorating areas, and their stores were reflective of that. I felt that, you know, department stores were kind of losing their identity and they were kind of losing their customers. And there's a lot of reasons for that. When Lip Brothers closed in 77, I mean, I talked to a lot of Wanamaker executives. And actually, the big stores on Market Street were actually sad. Well, of course, they were sad to see a competitor go. It was one less draw to go to Market Street. But they thought that they were going to get some of that business. They were going to get some of that spill. With Lip Brothers closed, they'll go to the other places. It didn't happen. It didn't happen at all. And that's where you wonder, were department stores really losing their relevance? I mean, I don't know. Growing up in the 70s, you had Corvettes, Esquine, Woolco, Grand City. Let's see if I forgot another one. Two Guys. And then Clover. And when Clover started taking took the Strawbridge and Clothier card, that was the end for my mother. In the 80s, things just were kind of merger crazy all over the country. And you had to get bigger in order to buy cheaper and to get stronger. And I mean, I'm a musician. I said that. And I was at the Aspen Music Festival in 1986. And I had heard earlier that year that Gimbel's was going to go. And I thought, Gimbel's isn't going to go. I mean, that's just kind of a threat. Someone's going to buy it. It's going to continue. Well, sure enough, I'm out there in Colorado, and Gimbel's, at least here in Philadelphia, the name was coming off the store. I never thought that would happen. And I realized at that point that these things were not forever. So what I started to do was I love going through microfilm.
ever since I was a kid. And I love reading newspapers. There's another industry that's gone through some turmoil, kind of a thing of the past. Hopefully not forever. And I would just want to learn more about these stores. I wanted to learn more about the stories. I wouldn't care about the shopping part. Yeah, my mother took me to places, to Pomeroy's in Willingboro. And, you know, we spent hours in there. I don't know what we did, but I didn't mind it. And, okay, so I wanted to know these stories and make a really long story short. I have... You know, you keep pressing the print button on the microfilm machine. And right now I have over 5,000 newspaper articles on department stores in the country. And it's the largest in the country, all indexed by city, state, and store. And it's on the second floor of my house. And I've been collecting them since the mid-80s. And everyone's always been really impressed with it. But I've always been that question of, what are you going to do with all this? And, okay, I'll make one last reference to music, and it's that sometimes we do these concerts where you have to be interactive. And sometimes you don't, the audience may, if it were more mature an audience, things kind of grind to a halt through some of that interaction. So in order to kind of liven it up, I ask people to shout out a city, and I'll name their store. So if anybody wants to shout out a city... I'll take you on and see if... I mean, it has to be a city, though. Don't get...
St. Louis.
One at a time. Pittsburgh. I could really get this going with Kaufman's Gimbel's Horns. You want to go to Boggs and Buell and Rosenbaum's? Don't point your finger at me. Someone said St. Louis. Famous bar, Sticks, Bear, and Fuller. And the hardest store to do research on, Scruggs Vandervoort Barney. Give me another city. Minneapolis, Dayton's, Powers, and Donaldson's. Who was over here?
Indiana, Pennsylvania.
Oh, God, this is where I start getting. Bonton was probably had a branch there.
No.
Who?
Brody's.
Mm-hmm. All right, now we're getting small. Give me. Okay. All right, you got a hand.
Los Angeles,
Robinson's, May Company, Broadway. Okay, well, Bullocks, yeah, I'm thinking, why am I stumbling? Okay, we could do this all night, but I want to let you know, I got to have 5,000 articles stuffed up here. So it's like, well, what are you going to do with it? I said Strawbridge & Clothier was my mother's store. So in 2006, when they decided to close, Macy's came in, took ownership and decided which were they going to keep, because they owned both, the old Wanamaker store or the Strawbridge's store. They decided to pull out of Strawbridge's. And I couldn't go there because it was just kind of, it was too hard for me. Because I didn't want to see it closing. The last meal my mother had as I drove her to Florida was in the Corinthian room. And I just didn't want to see all the signs saying that it was going down. I drove my daughter up from Baltimore, and we had our final meal in the restaurant, and she got her hair cut there. But I never went back because I didn't want to see the store close. I didn't want to see it in that condition. So fast forward to September 8th, 2006. This is the final day of the life of Strawbridge's. The next day, the Macy's signs will go up. I decided, okay, I want to go and see the last day of Strawbridge's. So I went to the Ardmore store, Suburban Square, met a friend. I wanted to be there. I mean, here it is, over 70 years it's been there. I wanted to be part of that last day with the newspapers and the signs and the people reminiscing. Nobody was there. Nobody was there. And I just felt nobody cared. And I was just, and I felt like kind of an idiot too, because I dragged my family up. And I just kind of drove home to Baltimore feeling a little sad. And I thought about, I should write about this day. But then writing just kind of scared me. You know, on the internet's kind of fun and it's kind of dangerous at the same time. I did find some solace that there are other department store fans, nuts, as myself, that are out there. And it's always nice to know that you're not alone. And I found this one site called departmentstorehistory.net, and people were writing in questions. And I found it, and this wonderful author, this great person, runs it. And their questions were kind of unanswered, many of them. And I wrote to her saying, I kind of know these answers. So I make, okay, here I am. I've gone from an oboist. I'm also town crier. You heard that. That's a whole other lecture. And now I'm an expert on department stores. And so then I got a call from my the publisher that's currently with these books, History Press. And they said, how would you like to write a book on filings? And everyone's been telling me, you gotta write a book, you gotta write a book. And I thought about it, got too scared, and said, no, it'd be different if it was Hutzlers. Because I'm in Baltimore. Hutzlers. What you equate Wanamakers with Philadelphia, that is Hutzlers. I can't call and say in writing Hutzlers was the best, was the premier store, department store in Baltimore, because we also had the Heck Company, and they funded the chair next to me in the symphony. So it was one of the finest stores in Baltimore. So I figured, well, let's try it. Because I didn't think anybody really remembered Hutzlers. I didn't think anybody cared. And again, the internet's dangerous and you start finding people. I promise we will talk about Wanamakers. It's coming up. And I met with this one couple that I found on the internet. And they emailed me back at 6 in the morning and said, we have to meet tonight. And I met with this couple who were buyers there. And they said, you write this book, just you wait. And I'm thinking, yeah, I mean, we all have our passionate places here in Philadelphia, whether you want to be a Wanamakers or Strawbridge's shopper or any of the others. And I'm thinking, what's the difference? Hutzler's Baltimore, fine. Yes, I love the store. Long death of a store. And I just figured, yeah, okay. And I wrote the book. And that first book signing, there were 200 people waiting in line that waited for over 2 hours for my signature. I'm a musician. I'm an oboist. That's all I've done. I have no right even talking to you today. I don't have a degree in this. All I have is a passion for this stuff, and it's a passion for history. And it was just an amazing experience, an absolutely amazing experience. I decided then, a friend of mine said, did you check your sales ranking on Amazon? I didn't even know what that was. I went through 6 printings to Christmas from November to December. I was outselling Danielle Steele and Mark Twain. Thank you. Thank you. So I knew that I was not alone. So I decided to try it again, not out of a gimmick, not out of just taking advantage of something. I wanted to look at Wanamakers because I really felt that as a business, it was not really properly told. It was not really properly documented. And maybe properly is not the right word, because there's some wonderful books out there. And I actually left them in my car across the lot so I could show them to you today. And they're great books about the man. Bill Zolker, Herb Hershkowitz wrote some great books. There's a great book by Ray Biswanger, Friends of the Wanamaker Organ, who is, that whole organ staff that's still in that store right now, it is a gift that you have here in Philadelphia. But they didn't really cover the business. That's what intrigued me. And I also thought, because I don't have control over the title. And they came up, they were really happy with it. And it was Wanamakers, Meet Me at the Eagle. Meet Me at the Eagle, fine. I bought mugs of it. I have scarves that say that. It's all over the place. And people have been meeting at the Eagle for over 100 years now. But it's not Wanamakers like that. It's John Wanamaker. Kind of in that same voice that John Facend used for the light show. But we had to differentiate from the man and the store. So after a deep depression, I did figure that was okay. I grew to accept it because John Wanamaker here, it always reminded me of John Hancock. That same proud signature, that symbol, that identity that we had here in Philadelphia. And that's part of the fascination I have with these stores. It's part of our fabric. They're part of our identity. We are all different, whether you want to believe it or not. Wanamaker's defined Philadelphia to me. I mean, whether we weren't shopping here or not, there wasn't a time where I wasn't in Center City where I at least walked through that store. It's Philadelphia's most famous interior passageway. Whether we want to acknowledge it or not, we just go through there anyway. We don't even pay attention. We just walk through it because that's just what's expected to do. And if you want to do something fascinating, just stand at that eagle and watch people today look that are in there for the first time or the first time in many years and look at their eyes.
It's amazing. But, you know, as I said, this book is not so much about the man, it's about the store. But you can't talk about the store without talking about the man. Some people may feel that I didn't talk enough about the man. And that was a conscious decision. If you want more about the man, buy Bill Zolker or Herb Hershkowitz's books. They're wonderful. They'll cover that for you. And mine covers some of that. It's the business. But I'm going to talk about the man right now. Some stuff I didn't cover in the book that I just want to share. Because this goes back to like 1850. Yeah, John Wanamaker was born in South Philly. His parents were bricklayers. Father. And when he was 12 years old, the story goes that he went to buy a piece of jewelry for his mother for Christmas. And he picked something out, and the man began to wrap it, and then he saw something else. And he wanted to change his mind. And the man that ran the store said, no, you can't. You already purchased it. You already wrapped it. You're stuck with it. And he wouldn't allow the exchange. And Wanamaker said he vowed that if he ever opened a store one day, it would be run differently and customers would be treated fairly and kindly. Of course, he did open a store. He did it in 1861, just a few days before the Civil War started. He did it with the help of his brother-in-law, Nathan Brown, and they named the store Oak Hall, Wanamaker & Brown. I have no idea why it's called Oak Hall, Wanamaker & Brown. I've never seen a definition of why he chose the name Oak Hall. But, and if any of you know, please tell me at the end of this. I'm dying to know. It was a men's and boys store, 6th and Market Street, next to where Washington spent time here in Philadelphia. And what set it different was Wanamaker always had this knack for advertising. And what he did was before the store opened, he put these posters around that just said W&B. Big posters, little posters. He also sent balloons out with tickets in there. If you found the balloon, you could take it to the store. You got a free suit. This was all part of his way of reaching out to the public. And he also, in 1865, came up with the famous slogan, "One price and goods returnable." Wasn't the first person to ever do that, but was the first person to do it in a big way, in a big city. There were four cardinal rules of his business, and that was full guarantee, one price, cash payment, and cash returned. And some say this was the beginning of the new way of modern retailing, how that was progressing. He was very loyal to his church. You look through all these stores across the country, and it's amazing. You'll go to Phoenix, Arizona, you'll go to Sacramento, California, and you have these names that are very definably Jewish. Because many merchants were Jewish. You did have Jewish merchants here in department stores. You had the Litt family. You had Snellenbergs. You had Gimbel's when they came to town. Philadelphia, you had Wanamaker and Strawbridge's, Strawbridge and Clothiers. Both of those families are Quakers. Wanamaker was an evangelical Protestant. Quite different. His early job, he was a secretary of the YMCA. He was said that he disliked tobacco, but he hated alcohol. And he gave out abstinence pledge cards with a picture of Lincoln on them. And they would say, bring the youth to faith in Christ. And I wonder, is this part of an early advertising kind of thing? Not to disrespect that, but he was always thinking about bringing people, bringing youth to his church, bringing people to his store. He also founded the Bethany Sunday School, which became the largest Sunday school in America.
And that was also became largest because he got a donation from a merchant that followed the same type of business principles and the same religious and moral principles of a man in New York, Alexander Tierney Stewart, who is arguably could be the first department store in the country. Arguably. Don't tell that to people in the Mormon church because they like to say Zion's Cooperative Mercantile Institution is the first department store in the country out of Salt Lake City. And they're the first company to organize, to operate, to sign on as a department store officially. But Stewart was Wanamaker's mentor. And in 1874, he purchased the abandoned Pennsylvania Railroad Depot right there at 13th and Market. I mean, the train lines had changed, and it was just this wooden structure, and it was abandoned. But it was the largest interior structure in Philadelphia, and he wanted to buy, and he bought it. He bought it for like $500,000, and that was going to be his new store. And he wanted it open in time for the 1876 centennial here. And before he got it open, he did have a couple evangelists, Dwight Moody and Ira Sankey, to put on a revival in there because it was the largest space in Philadelphia in the interior. And that was also reflective of his values and his devotion to the church. And he did open it. It was a men's and boys store. It opened on March 20th, 1876. And it was just as much of a tourist attraction as anything else here. The Liberty Bell, Independence Hall, people wanted to see the largest store in the country. And it was called the Grand Depot. About a year later, he decided he wanted to add more than just men's and boys clothes. So he closed it and rethunk, nice word for a writer, the way to set up the store. And he added women's clothes, he added scarves, he added textiles, and he opened it a year later, and he called it a new kind of store. 71,000 shoppers came there the first day, and he never referred to it as a department store. It was a composite store. Didn't like the term department store. The store had a lot of firsts in retailing, and I'll read a couple of them. In 1885, he renamed it Wanamaker's, and in 1876, it had the first restaurant in a department store. 1877, the first to bring fashions from Paris and Berlin. We'll talk a little bit more about the Paris aspect later, especially as we talk about one of our co-sponsors. 1878, the first store to have electricity. 1879, but he was the 1878. He also invented the white sale. That was his thing, the white sale. That's a way to bring people into the store after the Christmas holiday shopping season. The white sale. And following year, he's the first person to have a full page advertisement in a newspaper. 1880, pneumatic tubes. I assume you all know what that is. 1881, Insurance Association for Employees. All these were revolutionary for a business like this. In 1888, Wanamaker was always really involved in politics, really interested in politics. He was very involved in the Republican Party. And he also was financially involved in the Republican Party as well. And Benjamin Harrison, when he was president in 1888, chose him to be the Postmaster General. He thought Wanamaker, with his strong moral beliefs and also his business knowledge, could really turn that department around. And it kind of did. I mean, he's the one that came up with rural free delivery, parcel post, commemorative stamps. He also wanted to combine the telephone and telegraph part of the industry, but that didn't go because they just felt it was going to be too expensive. And he continued as Postmaster General until 1892. But 1896 was the big year for him. And that's, first of all, is when he founded the John Wanamaker Commercial Institute, where you had the cadet corps. And this was the era before public education was in the way that it is now, or available to so many people. This is where you went. You would go there, you would have your studies, and you would also learn how to do a business, how to work in a business. You would learn your trade. And this was for men and women. And this started in 1896. And on the back table, there are some trinkets, some symbols from the John Wanamaker Commercial Institute. You'll hear people in Philadelphia talk about their grandmothers being a cadet in the past. And you may wonder what that is. That's what it is. It was that big. It was that important. He also went ahead and his mentor store, he had long died, A.T. Stewart. His store was in receivership in New York. He couldn't let the A.T. Stewart store just die there. And he heard that it was dissolving. So he took an all-night train to New York and purchased the store. Store's located at 9th and Broadway. Beautiful store. And he wanted to make his mark in New York. Here he is, king in Philadelphia. If he can make it in New York, that's it. That's a huge accomplishment. That's a huge thing for a merchant. I mean, you combine the Philadelphia and New York Wanamaker stores, it made the largest retail emporium in the world. And people flocked to that store when it opened because he filled it with all these unusual merchandise. We're talking about Paris. We will get to Paris. All these things that were not available in that big way to New York audiences. And they came. And they came for a full month. And then they slowed down. Store was in the wrong part of Manhattan. Still kind of, I mean, you could say it's in the wrong part of Manhattan in the way that it's not in a retailing corridor. Whether it's 14th Street in the earlier times or 34th Street, as you could say, in the 30s, 40s, and on. It was in the wrong place. But he refused to give up on that store, and he pumped a lot of money into it because he felt that if he failed in New York, everyone would know it. He could not allow that store to fail. Back in Philadelphia, because it's interesting, with the book, I do have to talk about New York because there's not much that's publicly out there on Wanamaker's in New York. And I know we're in Philadelphia right now, but he did have this huge emporium there. And it was fun. Before we did a Carnegie Hall concert this past November, I got to do a lecture at the New York Public Library branch. And it's fun to have some Wanamaker people that haven't even thought of Wanamakers for over 50 years come and want to learn a little bit more about that building that currently houses a Kmart at 8th and Broadway. But back in Philadelphia, here he is with the Grand Depot, and he sees that as a wooden fire trap. And he wants to redo it. He wants to build a new store, a new monument. So he interviews architects, and settles on Daniel Burnham. Daniel Burnham is a wonderful architect. You look at the Flatiron Building, Union Station in D.C., Marshall Fields in Chicago. I mean, these great commercial buildings, and he hires him. And he also hires him to do an addition to the New York store. People in Philadelphia were angry. Why did he have to hire somebody from Chicago when he's so loyal to Philadelphia? This is a Philadelphia man. Why is he doing this? But I guess we all got over it. And he decided to go ahead. And in 1904, construction started on that store that you see right now, that Wanamaker building. The first section was built in 13th and Juniper. The second section was an L section on 13th and Market, and then encompassing the Grand Court. And then the Chestnut Street side was the last part. It was all built in sections. The business never stopped operating during its construction. It took a number of years. It took around 7 years to build because we were also going through some economic trying times here in the country. And he wanted to make sure he could always pay his bills, pay his employees, pay for the merchandise. And at that point, he was running this big store in Philadelphia and New York. New York opened in 1907, the full building there. And it was really popular for about a month. Honestly, you go through the records and it's really, you know, it was in the wrong place. But 1907 was also an important thing to Wanamaker because he had that wonderful estate, that beautiful estate, that old English estate, Lindenhurst, there on County Line Road heading out to Jenkintown. And an electrical fire happens. And Wanamaker, his big thing was art. And that estate was filled with art and antiques. It was also filled with his biography he was written on Martin Luther that people were anticipating, that people were hoping for. The whole place went up. Firemen, neighbors went in. They cut paintings from the frames, brought them out into the snow, and they saved as many as they could, but they couldn't save everything. And one of the things they also couldn't save was a pipe organ that John had given to his son, Rodman. And two of the paintings that thankfully were saved, and those of you who know Wanamaker's well from the past, were the two paintings by Michael de Munkacsy, Christ Before Pilate, and, I'm having a little brain freeze, and Christ the Calvary. Those two paintings. Those paintings were hung in the Grand Court every Lent. You would have seen those because he wanted to open people up spiritually while they were shopping. That's the thing. He wanted to bring culture to the masses. Rodman. Rodman Wanamaker, I'm not going to say was his favorite son, but he was so loyal to Rodman. And I'd say he could have been his favorite son, but Tom was his oldest son, and Tom was set up to run the business. Rodman was into music, art, and culture so much that he didn't think there was a place for him in Philadelphia, so his mother even encouraged him to move to Paris, which he did in 1888, and with his wife, Fernanda. He became the buyer of all the European merchandise, and he also helped purchase art for his father to display. Now, one of our co-sponsors is the Yarden Theater, currently having the play Wanamaker's Pursuit. Yes, it's about a man, Nathan Wanamaker, who's a grandson of Wanamaker. And no, there was no Nathan, but there was a Ron Rodman. And Nathan's in Paris. Rodman loved Paris, lived in Paris. It's a wonderful play. I really encourage you to see it if you have any fascination for this time period and this way of life. And I can't encourage it. They were very kind and gave me opening night tickets, and it really was a thrill. Tom died also in 1907, another boom to the Wanamaker family, and Rodman was forced home to run the store. And he was in charge of running New York. And the thing with New York is he had an auditorium built in that store, had New York's largest pipe organ installed. It's an auditorium half the size of the Metropolitan Opera. It was huge. It was an Austin organ built in Hartford, Connecticut. And it's not uncommon for Wanamaker, because you had that organ that burned. And he also had an organ in his old store at the Grand Depot. That was all part of his fascination, bringing art and culture to the masses. When he built this new store, he wanted to make it different. So what did he want to find that perfect organ? And he felt that he found it after some research. In 1904 St. Louis Exposition, the World's Fair, they had an organ there made by the Los Angeles Art Organ Company. It actually helped put that company in bankruptcy, because it was an art organ. It was beautiful. It was huge. It's the world's largest. Had around 10,000 pipes. It was stored in a warehouse. It was stored in there until Wanamaker found it in 1910 for 6 years. They brought it to Philadelphia in 13 railroad cars. And while he was there, he was also fascinated with that eagle, which was also on display at the exposition. That eagle, that two-ton eagle, with 6,600 feathers on it, 1,600 alone on its head, all individually handcrafted, that was to be installed on the first floor of the Grand Court. They had to put extra beams underneath that floor to make sure that that would even support it. And those were two, you know, of the obvious things that we see today that John wanted to bring in there. What's interesting is you read some of the articles, and the Philadelphia Zoo came and they were asked to analyze the bird. Was it a boy or a girl? Is the eagle a boy or a girl? So they did. They came in there because, like, you can't really tell. I mean, it's easier on other things. And they examined it, did all these like research and tests, and, you know, compared, and they decided that they didn't know. So we don't know if the eagle is a boy or a girl. But Rodman was still really he was a fascinating man. He was a loyal man to his father. The Milrose Games, that big track and field event, That's also rumored to be where the stars and the Star Spangled Banner was first sung before a sporting event.
And also the PGA, Professional Golfers Association, with the Wanamaker Trophy. Rodman's behind both of them. That store was completed, don't have an official date, in 1911, the one that we have down there, that we refer to as the Old Wanamakers usually. And 1911, but it was dedicated in December 30th, 1911, by President Taft, the only commercial business building ever dedicated by a president. And if you don't believe me, go in there now and go to like costume jewelry, move away some of the shelves, and you'll see the star on the floor for where Taft stood. The other thing that I want to mention is that when the Philadelphia store was completed, they had the big radio towers there. It had a Marconi telegraph station. So did the New York store. And the first wireless communication in the country, in the world, was a 15-minute communication between the Wanamaker's Philadelphia and New York store. You know, I got a cell phone in my pocket. That's no big deal, but that's a big deal. That's part of Wanamaker's commitment to just, you know, doing something different, expanding. There's also that story about the Titanic. David Sarnoff, who became president of RCA, was an operator at the Marconi station in New York. And the word was that he got the word of the Titanic sinking. And he, you know, announced it. And people did crowd outside of Wanamaker's in New York to find a list of survivors. But we're finding out that that wasn't necessarily true as far as him being the first person. He did get some of the words, some of the news. But that is part of the claim that that they like to have there with the New York store. It was common for Wanamaker to spend one day here in Philadelphia and then go to New York for the next day, and then come back here for one day and go to New York for the next day, and then come back to Philadelphia. And he did this for many years. And you can only do that for a certain amount of years. It really took a toll on his health. In 1922, in December 22, he took ill. Not the first time, but his family was at his side here. They knew it was close. Everyone was by his side except for Rodman. Rodman was working at the New York store. He hurried in the train to get back here to Philadelphia. It was too late. The only person of his family, the devotion between that father and his son, you could read it in the letters downstairs, and he wasn't there for that. Philadelphia went into a deep mourning. So did New York to some degree. But Philadelphia, they closed schools. They closed the drapes in the window. There was a minute of silence, I believe, in all the businesses. I mean, it was a huge deal when Wanamaker, that was a state funeral. And it wasn't that long later that, I mean, Rodman was sick too. Rodman, who was now in charge of the business, now the oldest son, he wanted to carry on his father's legacy, and he also wanted to memorialize his father. You know, we're here in Center City, we hear that bell every hour on the hour, and everyone kind of knows what time it is, and they hear it coming from City Hall. And it's not coming from City Hall. It's the founder's bell on top of what is now the PNB building, but was the Lincoln Liberty building, which was constructed in 1932. But that bell was brought over because Rodman commissioned it. He wanted a bell that could be heard for 30 miles. And he found that bell in England, and they brought it over. It's to be the largest bell in the Western Hemisphere. They went to ring it, and it only went so far. They didn't realize, too, or acknowledge that other buildings were going to dampen. It didn't have that 30-mile radius that they had hoped for. But that bell that you hear, that's John Wanamaker's bell. That's a memorial that Rodman gave. His creed is on that bell that you hear every hour on the hour except for Sundays. As I said, Rodman, I mean, he had kidney problems. By 1928, the kidney failure kicked in. He was dead in Atlantic City. And yes, we had a big mourning here, but with his death. But he kind of looked at his family. And his son, Captain John Wanamaker, John's grandson, I will say that Rodman referred to him as an alcoholic addicted to pills and powders, and his own self-pleasure far exceeded anybody else's well-being. Rodman questioned whether the family was capable of carrying on the business, Wanamaker's. And this is usually where books drop off, with the Rodman's death. And this is where I kind of wanted to pick up with my book. He came up that we didn't know until he died that he came up with a trust. And that was that if Rodman were to die, no family member could manage the business. No family member could be involved in it. They would serve on the board of directors, make those type of decisions, but couldn't manage the retail operation of it. And according to that trust, they could receive their stipend for being on the board, but the trust could not be dissolved until 21 years after the death of his last granddaughter. That's a pretty strictly worded trust. So the Wanamaker family left the running of that store, at least in the managerial sense. They weren't allowed to be there. Professional managers came in. But that still didn't mean that Wanamaker's wasn't the huge store that it was here. And you look at all the things that also that you remember with Wanamaker's, with the Crystal Tea Room, which they changed to the Crystal Room later in the 1970s because they wanted to update it and want to take the word tea out of there. Every Lent, you had those Munkacsy paintings there. And, to give spiritual enrichment to the shoppers. And you know where that Borders is closing now. That was the men's store. They built that in 1932. That was a special men's store. And that was that building there, that Lincoln Liberty building, the PMB building, was built by the heirs of the Rodman Wanamaker Trust. Rodman wasn't alive when that building was completed. And one of the reasons they wanted to build that, he wanted to have that corner, was William Penn said that was ye center of ye city. And Wanamaker wanted to have a store at ye center of ye city. And he finally did. Women that were shopping there, the Tribu shop, that exclusive shop there. I called it Tribo for many months while I was doing this book until I was corrected. And that was the designer shop in town. The only other place that really could compete with it was Dan Duskin. I mean, the other ones, yeah, you have Bonwateller, Blum store, all that stuff. It really, the Tribu shop was different. Was really heads and shoulders above many of the places here in Philadelphia. Different story in New York. Things are still not going well. It was one of the big, a big industry analyst who said it was known for its empty, cavernous aisles. Bad business decisions in New York. In 1932, Rockefeller offered them property one block away from Rockefeller Center. They thought about it for a while and said no. Metropolitan Life developed Parkchester up in Bronx, kind of an early community, planned community. They wanted a Wanamaker store there. They thought about it, and they said no. And then there was another opportunity at 46th and Madison to get that store out of 8th and Broadway, get some people in there, and they thought about it, and they said no, that they were looking at other opportunities. So here are all these lost opportunities that are hitting the Wanamaker store in New York. That beautiful auditorium with that fabulous organ in New York, water damage. It did not have the care that was going on here in New York. And by the way, that commercial institute, some of the students, actually their job was to work in that organ shop. Remember, Wanamaker Centennial Organ Week is in June, third week of June. Go there. Spend something. Stick your head in there. You owe it as Philadelphians, too, for that 100th anniversary of that organ. Just want to throw that pitch in there. I'm not making any money from that, but I just thought I'd mention. But that auditorium organ, where you went and heard a recital in New York, they chopped that up into three pieces, and the Dumont Television Network moved in. That store was really finding another way of existing. But Wanamaker's best business decision was in 1950, in November 1950, where they opened that store in Wilmington.
And if you know, that store was built in, they say, in a country club atmosphere in a residential section just a few miles from downtown, not on any commercial street, so to speak. And it was a beautiful store. And what did it also have? Parking. We didn't have to deal with parking. It was, Wilmington did not have the type of retail establishment, these grand emporiums that other cities had. You look at the Wilmington paper at that time, and if you wanted to go shopping at a department store, you saw department store ads. They were all to take the train to Philadelphia. Yeah, they had some. If you remember Wilmington Dry Goods, that was more of a discounter. And they had some of the other smaller stores, Kennard's and Crosby and Hill. Not to the extent of merchandise that Wilmington Wanamakers had. And it also was the only market where it beat out Strawbridge's. At that point, Strawbridge's was really in the race to the branches. They had already moved to the suburbs, if you want to say suburbs, with Ardmore in 30 and Jenkintown in 1932. They opened up their Wilmington store in 52. It was not Wanamaker's. And I mean, one of the things that I had to do with this book, maybe this is a little out of order, but I'm going to say it now anyway. You have to talk about the other stores, I believe, if you write a book on a department stores in the city. That's why in Hustlers I spend a chapter talking about the other stores. In Wanamaker's I do too. I mean, I can't tell it at length, but I at least, there's people want to know. You want to know a little bit about Strawbridge's, and I try to throw in some fun facts. Gimbel's. Gimbel's, yeah, we talked about the closing of Gimbel's, the changing of Gimbel's. When was the last time we really shopped at Gimbel's, beginning in the early 80s? But we all expected a Thanksgiving parade. I think we were taking these stores for granted as well. But you got to tell that story, and I can't tell you how many Gimbel employees came up to me during Wanamaker book signings. And I realized there is a whole other society out there that I think has been ignored. Lip Brothers, yeah, but the one that brings the most smile to people's faces, and you have to be of a certain age, is Snellenberg's. People love Snellenberg's. Same owner as Lip Brothers, basically towards the end. They were at 12th and Market. And, you know, Lip Brothers took over their branch stores in 1962. And in 1963, they decided one day, 10 before 2 in the afternoon, we're done. Leave the store. Employees, stay where you are. We'll give you instructions. Stores close. Goodbye. Thank you. Not a total surprise to the business community, but people like Snellenberg's. Wanamaker's next branch was Wynwood in 54. Nice branch. Did well. Didn't do incredible. Didn't do the volume as some of the Strawbridge branches, but in 54, the family just gave up on that New York store. It was time. It was overdue, and it was. I mean, it's a huge icon. I mean, Wanamaker left the New York scene for the most part. They still had a branch in Yonkers that they were committed to, and up until 1995, when Wanamaker ceased to exist as we know it, there was still a neglected branch, huge branch in Yonkers, New York, that they were committed to. And one of the reasons it did well is because it was out of the city tax zone. You could shop there and save some money because it was just outside of New York's limit. Philadelphia, though, that was the huge success story. A couple people come to mind, and that's Frederick Yost. And he was a theater person from Yale. And he's the one that decided, let's bring the monorail in to that toy department on the 8th floor. And it was him that also decided about the light show. Yes, there's been festivities and all in that grand court for years, but it was his knowledge of theater, of display, of incorporating lights and water fountains, bringing those dancing waters in there. eBay you just kind of get out of control. You're welcome to look at the first brochure for the Wanamaker light show there, when it actually more was referred to as the Christmas Cathedral. And over the years, they always change it. Frederick Yost is the one that put that store, helped develop Wanamaker's flair for advertising. But the other one is Reeves Witherell. And you go in the back, and, you know, I said the Historical Society here has this wonderful collection, the Wanamaker papers. And you'll see all the many photos of celebrities that came to sign their pictures when Wanamaker celebrated their 100th anniversary in 1961. I went through the files here as much as I could because Reeves was here from 1954 to 1979. And I couldn't count everybody, but there was about 1,300 celebrities came to Wanamaker's. If you were a public figure and you were coming to Philadelphia, you were kind of expected to make your appearance at the Grand Court at noon and make your appearance. You look at the pictures. I have some in the book. And, you know, the list of people from Grace Kelly, of course, who is a Philadelphia person just as much as anything, to all the stars up to Henry Winkler. They all made their appearances there in that Grand Court. That was just what you did here. But 1961, everything changed with the Cherry Hill Mall, which is actually the Cherry Hill Shopping Center. That was changed later. Strawbridge's, of course, I mean, they spent many years helping to develop that. And when it was their turn, they had a thing in their lease, a clause in their lease, like many places do, where they helped to choose their anchor store, the second competing anchor store. They went in there and they decided to go with Bambergers from Newark, a division of Macy's. They did not want to compete with the Philadelphia store. And if you look at any shopping mall in the Philadelphia area, up and through the 1990s, you will not see a Strawbridge's and a Wanamaker's in the same mall, except for one, Christiana, at the very end. That's it. That was in 1991. That's when competition was basically kind of, an identity was kind of changing. But Strawbridge's kept out Wanamaker's. They opened up in Morristown, but Morristown wasn't Cherry Hill. And they always had to play catch up from there. And, you know, sales in general were just dropping. At one point, one quarter of all retail trade in the city occurred on Market Street with those six department stores. The one I didn't mention is Frank and Cedar. But those six department stores, one quarter of all retail business in the city. That's unheard of. The largest concentration of department stores in this country is at 8th and Market with the corner of Gimbel Strawbridge's and Litt Brothers. But sales were dropping. You see department stores all across the country bringing in festivals, bringing in special events. That's to keep people in the city. People wanted to leave. I understand. You wanted a car. You wanted your own plot of land. Plus, things were changing. And that's what I learned with the first book, was that society was changing. Whether you want to look at issues with integration, whether you want to issues with women in the workforce, or you want to look at issues like value and convenience with suburban shopping. E.J. Corvette put the fear of God in these stores. No one discounted like they did, especially in hard goods, and they had parking. You didn't have to fight parking here. But the other thing, it was no longer a social thing. People weren't coming down here to taking their daughters to the Crystal Tea Room with gloves on, spending the day not browsing and socializing. That was going away. You also had the younger crowd in the late 60s, the younger crowd, God, I sound like an old man, who didn't want to shop in the same stores that their grandmother shopped. It was the now thing. They wanted that to change. And you know, the no more were there team boards where department stores were going into high schools and other types of schools to see what the trends were. So, I mean, you could go in and model your clothes in the restaurants and whatnot and get your tips on what was popular in the stores. That wasn't happening anymore. That was really going away. So, I mean, I really realized with Hustlers how the demise of these department stores was how society was changing. And I know that that's part of my fascination because I was watching an industry going away. It was still there. I witnessed it. And, you know, living in New Jersey, seeing Camden, Newark, Trenton, Atlantic City, it's downtown, you're seeing that go piece by piece, sometimes bigger piece than bigger by bigger piece. And I'm sorry to say I was fascinated, because I wanted to know more about how these places that were so important in our lives and our identities could go. And that's when the family knew they had to get out. They wanted to get out. They secretly put the stores up for sale. They were allowed to do that. 1976, they quietly put it for sale. In 78, they were purchased by Carter Holly Hale from Los Angeles, the people that ran the Broadway. So the person that's shouted out Los Angeles before. And they got it. Wanamaker's got it off their hands. There was an ugly fight in the boardroom between how we should sell this store. I will leave it at that. But it divided that family and hurt that family so much. And I heard all sides of it when I was talking to people, and I will not repeat what I was told, but there was a bad fight. And when I talked about that trust, where they still had to, 21 years after the death of the last granddaughter, I was also was told that how every year they had to meet. They had to be in that room. And this was a family that was torn, ripped apart, and they had to meet in that room once a year. Kind of a nice soap opera-y kind of story, but real hate and hurt was involved there. By the mid-70s, those stores were neglected. They really didn't have... They were dirty, they were dowdy, they were dusty. Look at the pictures. I mean, but it was still John Wanamaker. I mean, we still wanted, expected a store there like that. It's our identity. And they realized they had to keep that Center City store going. They had to keep it updated. Carter Holly Hale couldn't believe what they found financially once they took it over. The store was in financial turmoil, but the sale had already gone through and had already passed, and they realized what a mistake it was. And they decided Center City needed the most attention because that was the figurehead for the company. And they were afraid with Wanamaker's because if it was too weak, that would make them a target for a takeover. Because remember, we're in merger mania by now. And if Wanamaker, if their division appeared weak, they did not want a person to come in and suck the company up. They also didn't want to chop off floors. If they downsized that store, that huge store, that 2 million square foot building, if they downsized it, then that would show that it was in turmoil. And they didn't want to give that impression. But its sales per square foot were not strong. So they did put it for sale. In 1986, they decided to put it up for sale. And the first person that came to bid on it was Hess's in Allentown. My father's from Allentown. Hess's is an interesting place. It was quirky. Kind of a theatric place in the middle of a steel town, steel city. And they wanted that store, and they were offering half the price that was offered, and they even promised to rip the Wanamaker name off the building and slap Hess's on there. And they said no, that wasn't going to happen. But Woodward and Lothrop from Washington came in 1987, and their bid was accepted. Now, Woodward and Lothrop, or Woody's, I'll say Woody's now, even though I know it's Woodward and Lothrop, it's easier to say. Same customer as John Wanamaker, as in Washington. But that customer was older, that customer was more conservative, and the sales at that store weren't pulling their weight either. I mean, you got your Wanamaker's bag. It's kind of easy to slap on the Woodward and Lothrop thing. So you'll see these. They also did have that WL logo. That's part of their business. Kind of all fit there. But it's not really successful to have two weak organizations do not make a strong organization. But they were able to keep going. And one of the things that Woodward and Lothrop did is they had to downsize that building. I mean, that was the inevitable. So it went to 5 floors, cut the basement off. Gone was the crystal tea room. Gone was the piano department that was around for years, the Morgan Apothecary that everybody remembers. That was all gone. But the one thing they did do is they gave the papers to this organization here, Historical Society of Pennsylvania, and also the Atwater Kent, now the Philadelphia History Museum. Have a great collection. People always ask about the office. Wanamaker died in 1922. They left that office alone, didn't touch it. You could go up there in tours and see what it was like for the last day he was alive or in that store. And we still have the office. It was pulled from the store in 87, Woodward and Lothrop did give it, and it's now in the hands of the Philadelphia History Museum. I wanted to have them bring it here today, but they weren't agreeable to that. Only kidding, though. But, I mean, it would have been nice. One of the things one of the things that the office had was that John Wanamaker liked cats. Ceramic cats all over the office. Why did he like cats? No reason. Why do I like department stores? But some of the cats are on the back table with some of the collection that the Philadelphia History Museum brought today. Might be fun to go back there and take a peek at that. I always said that people wanted a store named John Wanamaker, but they just didn't want to shop there, at least in the early 90s. That's the way it was. We were taking these things for granted. We expected it. We expected Gimbel's to have a Thanksgiving parade. We expected Wanamaker's to be there. But it cost money to do those things. In 1994, Woodward and Lothrop filed for bankruptcy. The writing was on the wall. By 1994, horrible Christmas season. Horrible. It had to go. So they put it up for sale. First person to come in there was a combination effort between Macy's and JCPenney. You know, that meant the end of, you know, what was going to happen to Woodward and Lothrop and Wanamaker's. Unclear. And then by August, May Company came in. And they actually won the bid. And their plan at that point was to put the name Hex on the store. They were retiring the John Wanamaker name, the name that we associated here in Philadelphia and still associate with that building. That came off. And on came the Hex nameplate. And people were angry. They stayed away. Hex poured money into that Center City store, but people did not want a store named Hex. And they realized it was a huge disaster. And what are we going to do? Now, it was no secret that there was also, with a lot of these corporations, as the families get bigger, as they get older, the families fraction. They go off in different places. And they know that there was fractioning in the boardroom at Strawbridge and Clothier. So, Hex made a move for Strawbridge's. And it wasn't an easy fight in that boardroom. But they ended up purchasing Strawbridge's because they wanted to have the market dominance. That's what was big. At this point, department stores are fighting for survival. They're fighting for a piece of the market. I mean, you had places like Bambergers, now Macy's coming in. You had the upscale stores that had been on City Line Avenue for a long time, but now at King of Prussia and someone at Willow Grove. I mean, things were changing. Bambergers was the number one store in town, or Macy's. I mean, Bambergers left in 86, that name. So now they took over Strawbridge's. So that family, two families went away, and now they owned everything, and they knew they had to pull the Hex name off those old Wanamaker stores. That was a mistake, so they put Strawbridge's on. I wish I brought the picture with me today, but that old Wanamaker's building, for 4 months, operated as a Strawbridge's. They even had brass nameplates on it. But they couldn't afford to create bad will by not even showing the light show for a year. Even though the whole company was in a turnaround there, there was no way where that light show was going to go dark. So Mayo also owned Lord & Taylor. So after that, that's in 1997, they changed that to a Lord & Taylor, but they downsized it to three floors. And, you know, they were hoping that it was going to bring some more traffic here into Philadelphia, the Center City. It didn't do what was promised, but it's still, they knew better than to fool with the light show, even though the light show was literally falling apart. It was down to 11 minutes long, and the bulbs were literally breaking. They could only do it for every 2 hours instead of every hour because the system was so fragile. But they knew they had to keep that going. In 2006, everything changed when Macy's won control, 2005 kind of Federated Department Stores and also took over the May Department Stores Company. That's when you saw all these names go away. And here in Philadelphia, you saw Strawbridge's, you saw Filene's in Boston, Kaufman's in Pittsburgh, Famous Bar in St. Louis, Robinson's in Los Angeles, Ayers in Indianapolis, and there's more than that, and they all went away. That was the only part of regional identities we had left. And, you know, people did not look at it all that favorably. And it's still a struggle in many places. Look at Chicago. I won't even go there if there's a Macy's employee here. But that's still a real deep fight with the changeover from Marshall Field's. And do I think Marshall Field will return? Am I happy that there is a group of Chicagoans that are standing up for identity? Yeah. Because we're not all the same. I talk to audiences in Philadelphia. I talk to audiences in Baltimore. They're different audiences, and they should be, because we're not all the same. That's why I was fascinated with these stores as a kid, with all these different names, with all these different logos, different tastes, different whatever. It was different, and I think that's really important. The one thing that I know that I'll segue into, because it's kind of appropriate, is that in 1906, Philadelphia was kind of the home to Mother's Day. This is where Anna Jarvis she called it a fete of love and esteem that was to be carried out in every home in Philadelphia, where you would receive the blessing of the dutiful son and affectionate daughter, and it was dedicated to the best mother who ever lived, your own. And Wanamaker was the one that championed that to go on a national level, saying that it seems that if we all give our hearts to this loving service, it will become one of the most beautiful days of our lives. Go on this Chestnut Street side of the store now, and you'll see a plaque in memory of Mother's Day, the founding of Mother's Day here in Philadelphia. Maybe that's another part of the advertising genius that Wanamaker had, this background. Philadelphia History Museum, when I talked to it, I was at the Arden Theater when I'm watching Wanamaker's Pursuit. And yeah, I have some tchotchkes here, and tchotchkes is probably not the right word to use with Wanamaker's, but most of them are at the Arden Theater on display, a little mini museum courtesy of PayPal and eBay. And if you go to that play, which is a great play, stop by and see some of that. And we also have the tables in the back with from the Philadelphia History Museum. And when I talked to Kristen at the Arden, she said, well, we have the cats. And I was thinking, good. And I couldn't remember what the cats were. And that's, you know, it's Wanamaker's collection. We all have collections. And talking with Kristen the other day, she said that they also have the information from the Watsett Club. And it's like, what's that? And that's what it is. What's that? It's a club. You'll see the information back there if you want to take a peek. I mean, what's that? Between 1914 and 1918, Wanamaker's had this club with Mother Watsett, and it was a character that asked, what's that? And it was, you would perform. If you were a member of the club, you had to wear your little pin, and there was the characters Watsett, Pranko, and Strum. This is something I didn't know that existed when I wrote the book, and it's something that I didn't know existed even 2 days ago. But it's interesting to have it back there now. As I said before, with the Arden Theater, Nathan Wanamaker, that is a fictitious character based on Rodman, but great play. Go there. You'll get a little bit of a feel of that. So that's basically what I wanted to talk about. I'm working on my third book before I take a break. And that'll be out next year, and I believe the title is going to be Nobody But Nobody Undersells Gimbel's. And, you know, it's a different store than Wanamaker's, and it's a different story. And I don't really feel that story's been told as it should. And, you know, when Gimbel's closed in 86, that's when I really realized that nothing's forever. And all I want to do with these books, because this isn't my occupation, I just want to remember these stories. And it's really something to hear people tell me their stories. Because some are funny and some are bittersweet, because it's always, many of these memories are fond memories, and they evolve members of the family from the past. And 2 weeks before Hutzler's was done, my mother did pass away. And that's why I did had that book. I knew that was probably going to happen, dedicate it to her, because she's the one that really kind of through all this craziness taught me that we're not all alike and that's okay. And if these books do nothing else than just make you remember or reminisce or make you smile, that's all I kind of wanted to do, and just pay tribute to them. So thank you very much for coming. I know you had you wanted to make a reference to a raffle, and then I'll take any questions you might have.
Thank you.
If anybody has any questions, yes.
I love your book.
Thank you.
I covered it the day I got it. This is a two-part question. First part is, how did it do in sales? You said hospitals did really well.
Mm-hmm.
And the second part, I don't want to embarrass you, so believe me, the embarrassment will be all mine. But would you show us a little leg?
Yes, I can do that, and I'll explain that. Oh, God, I never should have done that in the first place. But yeah, how did the Wanamaker's book do? When I checked on, things slow down at this time of year, but at Thanksgiving, it was the number one book in business and retailing in the country. It has slowed down now. So, but that's great because people remember. I mean, I just want people to remember.
Now, I said my mother died, she passed away. It was cancer and Alzheimer's, very long. I mean, many of us go deal with that. It's very hard. And I never thought I would do this, but I wanted to memorialize my mom, and Strawbridge's was her store, so I decided I wanted a tattoo. And, you know, we all, Philadelphians, you know the seal of confidence. You know, Strawbridge's with the William Penn and the Money Let It Be Indian. So I thought it was really cool to have, like, a little tattoo on my ankle in memory of my mother. Well, they don't make them that small. I only have one mother, but I made the embarrassment of mentioning that to the Enquirer when they did a report.
As much as I love the press from the Enquirer, when we did that article, the woman that did it, I love her. I'm not yelling or yet, but we said that we would meet at the Eagle, and she was really late, and she's like, yeah, she's outside, she can't find it.
What's the polishing of the statue of the Wanamaker? You're on the facing the east part on City Hall Square. You will see
the statue there, John Wanamaker, citizen.
You don't really have to say much more than that. I do not know of a separate fund that takes care of that. There was a fund that many school children raised to have that statue made. I mean, that was a huge deal.
That was in 32. That's 4 years after Rodman died. But I do not know of a fund that does that, and I'm just glad it is. And I think is it the only statue around City Hall of its kind, like an individual person? It might be.
Yeah, there are Civil War generals.
Then it's just on that side, then. Okay.
And the City Hall, I mean, they have the whole...
The tourist office there, Greta, who is helpful with my book. I mean, she would know that too, but yeah, National Park Service would know something.
You mentioned about Rodman Wanamaker adding something to the store. Did he bring in the European goods?
Yeah.
Given his background.
Yes, he was in charge of Europe, bringing in the European fashions. You'll see the fans in the back that the History Museum brought, and you'll see like four buildings on there: Philadelphia, New York, London, and Paris. London and Paris were the buying offices. The Paris location was actually where they lived. But so they're not stores, but yes, that was his job was, yeah, because that's culture was his thing. That's what he was learning. And that's what you'll also, I mean, with the play, Wanamaker's Pursuit, it concentrates especially on fashion and also art as well. Yeah.
I'm interested in the commercial institute. It seems to me that was a rather enlightening thing for Wanamaker to do at a time when Henry Ford had people working on production lines. My father was one of them. He graduated from the university. And the bagpipes in general we got later than we have pictures of my aunt and holding a clarinet, and she also played. And I want to find more about that history story, so I'm going to go to class.
The best place, I can talk about it somewhat, but you got to get Bill Zolker's book. That's really the best resource for it. These kids, these students, were also used to, they're being taught, they're learning the trade, but they're also, bands and choruses, and they would put on big presentations in the grand court.
And John Philip Sousa conducted that band.
I think that's true. It disbanded in the 30s when it was no longer, you didn't have either John or Rodman around, but you also, public schooling was advancing. But there wasn't the need for that. But the cadets, I was talking back there. They were both men and women. And one of the women's role was to, men would come in their fancy cars and carriages into the Juniper Street entrances, and the women would take them up to the men's dining room. And that really wasn't seen as like a disrespectful thing, because they were also learning how to speak with men, powerful men, and also engage them in conversation. it was like an escort service. But that was also part of training, being able to treat, to socialize with people in high capacities.
So I think we're going to cut off the Q&A now, but Michael is going to be available if you have other questions you want to ask him, or if you want him to sign a book, his book that he's going to be selling. And we have wine and cheese out here on the landing. I'll stay on the landing. I'm going to swap the documents in the back.
And the first few people have the remain to get a book, one per customer, of the remaining John Wanamaker bags.
I have one.
Thank you.